This is Michael Gonneau with Insight to Israel, brought to you by America's Web Radio. And I want to say thank you to the guys at America's Web Radio that bring the truth of the Jewish state, its greatness, its contribution to the world as it leads the way in medicine, technology, and agriculture, and its vast amounts of humanitarian work that it does around the world, and its struggle for sovereignty and security. The truth that America's Web Radio, through Insight to Israel, brings to the grassroots of the United States of America, the patriot conservatives that stand with Israel. I want to say thank you, guys. You're the best. I also want to say thank you to everyone that contributes to Hershey's for Heroes, where Americans are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note on each one saying thank you to the Israeli soldiers for defending the Jewish state. Just recently got a box of Hershey's for Heroes from the U.S. military, and it was amazing to see that our soldiers took the time to put notes on each chocolate bar from one soldier to another in the defense of freedom. So thank you to everyone, to the soldiers in the United States. Thank you to everyone who's participating in the program. It is ongoing. I actually will be headed to a graduation of a group of young men in the Israeli Defense Force that will be finishing up basic training for a tank battalion. And I will be giving out some Hershey's for Heroes there. I will also be going to a base in the north to spend some time with the soldiers there and take them your regards, your greetings, and your message that you stand with them. So, if you would like more information on Hershey's for Heroes, you can email me at Michael A. Gonneau, G-A-N-O-E, at gmail.com. That's Michael A. Gonneau at gmail.com. So, I am here in, it's about 4:30 in the evening. The sun's about to set in Jerusalem, and it's been a beautiful day. I spent the weekend in Hebron, and with hundreds of Israelis that were celebrating the remembrance of the patriarchs. Adam and Eve are buried there, and Sarah, the wife of Abraham, is buried there, and many others. And it was a fantastic time. If you want to see my experience there, you can go to Facebook or you can email me and ask me specifically for those pictures and a report. And get on my email list so you can have some insight to Israel. But I'm here in Jerusalem. It's a beautiful day that's over with on a Sunday. And I'm here with a gentleman that I'm meeting for the first time. But I am thankful and very happy to have State Senator Tom Davis from South Carolina, who is just finishing up a week here in Israel. Senator, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. It's an honor. And I want to say thank you to Orly Benny Davis, who brought us together, who emailed me and said Senator Davis is coming to Israel. And I'll tell you, sir, I've lived here a year now, and I will tell you that my experience firsthand, you know, you have good and bad wherever you go.
Sure.
But I will tell you that the Jewish people here have treated me with such amazing hospitality and have blessed my life, turned me inside out, upside down, and they have been a huge contribution to my life, my personage. And I was always an advocate for Israel in the United States. Worked in politics for close to 15 years. But I never, there's nothing like, and you know this, as someone who is in politics and a public servant, if you will, there's nothing like boots on the ground.
Yeah, there's no substitute for actually being in a place, talking to the people, of that country, seeing the sights for yourself, talking with them about the issues. You can learn a lot on the radio, or you can learn a lot on television or reading the newspaper, but as you say, Michael, nothing substitutes for being here on the ground, and it's been a fantastic week for me.
Wow. And we're going to hear more about that, but I want to get to know you, sir. I want folks to get to know you.
Sure.
So I'm going to start off with the basics. Where were you born and raised? Obviously in South Carolina.
Okay. Well, no, not South Carolina, actually. I was raised in Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., in a town called Damascus, ironically enough. There's a Damascus, Syria here, obviously, but this is Damascus, Maryland, which is about 25 miles north of Washington, D.C. I then went to college at Furman University, which is in Greenville, South Carolina.
Nice.
And met my wife, Reed, at Furman. And then after 4 years at Furman, I went to law school back at the University of Maryland School of Law. And for the last 29 years, I have practiced law in Beaufort County, South Carolina, which is in the very southeastern part of the state, where Hilton Head is in Beaufort. And for the last 5 years, I've represented Beaufort County in the South Carolina State Senate. So half the time, I'm a lawyer in Beaufort, and the other half of the time, I'm a state senator in the state capital of Columbia.
Wow, wow, that's fascinating. I know Greenville very well. I actually went to school there. You've got Bob Jones there.
Oh, did you go to Bob Jones?
No, actually, I went to Holmes College of the Bible.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a fantastic school, and you have the BMW plant there.
We do. We have BMW is really has a presence there. A lot of the cars in North America, I think most are made in Greenville, more there than any other place in the United States. So it's quite a manufacturing part of the state.
Yeah. Let me ask you, it's amazing. What made you choose South Carolina to reside in? I guess because your experience there in school.
Well, I think it's, you know, a series of happenstance. I mean, you can plan a lot of your life, but it's funny how much of your life just happens. I mean, I went to Furman thinking that I could play golf. I wanted to be a professional golfer, so
nice.
I went to Furman, and I quickly realized that my game was nowhere near good enough to play professional golf, and so I shifted gears and did well in school and ended up going to law school.
Wow.
But along the way, I met a woman and fell in love with a woman who was from South Carolina, so that gets me to South Carolina, and then one day we were visiting her parents in Columbia. I think it was 1983. I was in my first year of law school. And her father said, you ought to go down to Beaufort, South Carolina, where they filmed The Big Chill, a movie called The Big Chill.
Yeah.
As Glenn Close and Kevin Kline and Jeff Goldblum and various others. And so we drove down to the coast and went to see where they filmed The Big Chill in Beaufort, South Carolina, and we absolutely fell in love with the town. I mean, Beaufort's an absolutely beautiful city on the water. And we walked around town, and I wrote down the names of the law firms in Beaufort and sent my resume. And one of them wrote me back and said, come back for an interview. And so I interviewed there. And then after I got out of law school, I started practicing law there. And I've been there for 29 years. So if I hadn't gone to Furman wanting to play golf, I wouldn't have met my wife. And I wouldn't have gone to Beaufort. And I would have never gone to the law firm. So those aren't things that you plan. They just sort of fall into place based on circumstances. So that gets me to South Carolina.
Wow. You know, it is... It is amazing when we look back on our life and see the blessings that have come out of a domino effect that we never expected.
Well, the old saying is, life is what happens while you're making other plans. And,
right.
And that certainly is the case with me.
Right. Wow, that's fascinating. You know, and I believe, I'm going to throw this tidbit in here. I believe, Senator Davis, that the simple fact that you came here for 1 week, I think something great is going to happen that will be able to not only bless your life, but Israel at the same time.
I think so. I think everything happens for a reason. And I happen to know very well. I've gotten to know Bill and Jenny Billick, who live on Hilton Head, which is part of my Senate district. And Bill Billick is a retired OBGYN who's very active in American-Israeli relations. And he has been after me to come to Israel to see for myself, you know, the things that you read about in the newspaper, whether it's, you know, Syria or Iraq or anything concerning the Middle East. Israel seems to be at the center of it. And I told him that this year would be the year that I would go, and things fell into place, and have just an amazing week. I mean, I can't even begin, maybe I'll begin tonight, to try to encapsulate, you know, what I've learned and how I feel about things, but I definitely are looking at things with different eyes and,
yeah,
and different thoughts.
Wow, wow. Let me ask you, what drove you, what gave you that unction, that desire to get into public service?
Well, I think public service, I've always enjoyed politics. I was a political science major at Furman, and so I really enjoyed political theory and political thought. When I was 34 years old, one of my college friends ran for governor of South Carolina, a man named Mark Sanford, and he called me up and asked me if, well, actually, in 94, he ran for Congress, and he called me up and asked me if I'd help him on his campaign, and I did. And then 6 years later, he called me up again and asked me if I'd help him on his run for governor. And so I went ahead and moved out of my home and moved into his basement in Charleston.
Wow.
And, along with his wife, ran his gubernatorial campaign, and he won. And then after he took office, I went back to my law practice in Beaufort. But it drove me crazy seeing him up in Columbia trying to work on the things and accomplish the things that we had talked about during the campaign.
Right.
And so I ended up taking a leave of absence from my law practice and went up and became his chief of staff. And so I was Governor Sanford's chief of staff for several years in Columbia. And then in 2008, I decided to go ahead and run for office on my own for state senate and was successful. I beat an incumbent there. And then I ran for re-election last year for a second four-year term. And so I'm in the first year of my second term.
Well, I'll tell you. So I worked in politics for a long time, and in the campaign sector, and it's tough. It's a lot of work. It is a lot of work.
It's you intellectually can understand it's going to be a lot of work, and people tell you it's going to be a difficult task, but until you get out there and start talking to people and trying to convince them why they ought to cast their precious vote for you, it's a humbling experience.
Yeah.
You really have to work hard. There's no substitute for getting out in front of as many people as possible, answering their questions, talking to them one-on-one, being honest with them about what you might do in certain circumstances. But as you go along, Michael, and as you get used to it, you develop a cadence and you develop a rhythm and you get comfortable right. talking to people and you get comfortable talking about ideas about how do we improve education or access to health care or working, you know, to make our infrastructure better or any number of things that come up. And after a while, it becomes second nature. But definitely starting out, it was something much more difficult than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, quite honestly, I've always been an outgoing person. But in relating to that, that's what's made my transition from the United States to Israel a lot smoother because, like you said, you reach out to people. You become accustomed to that, and you don't have those barriers that are normally up among most people.
You can't have them. I mean, if you're going to be a successful politician or a successful public figure, you can't live in isolation. You can't live in a vacuum. You've got to get out there, and you've got to talk to people. You've got to interact with them. You have to enjoy doing so, because one of the things the voters will pick up right away is insincerity,
right.
or they'll pick up on whether or not you're just saying, what you think they want to hear. So you have to be an extrovert, but you also have to be intellectually honest because the voters are very smart. And that's what makes democracies, I think, work.
Yeah.
People do get educated. People understand and perceive things to a much greater degree than a lot of people give them credit for. And it gets across to them. If you're speaking authentically and from the heart, they get that and you'll do well in politics. If
right.
you don't, you won't do well.
Right. So what about your children? How many children do you have?
My wife and I have been married for almost 29 years. We have three daughters.
Wow.
My oldest daughter, Elizabeth, is in her sophomore year at Clemson University.
Nice.
Up there just west of Greenville, South Carolina, in the northwest corner of the state. My middle daughter, Grace, is 12 years old. She's in seventh grade. And my youngest daughter, Claire, is 8, and she is in third grade.
Wow.
And so all girls in my family, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, wow, that's great. So when you told your family, you looked at your wife. Now, it's too bad she couldn't come with you. I know there's responsibility.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because initially when we talked to Bill and Jenny Billick, my friends, about coming to Israel and visiting here, they had invited both of us. And I talked with my wife about going. And she quite frankly said, I don't think that both of us ought to go to Israel at the same time. We have responsibilities to our children. So, you know, the perception is, Michael, that in Israel, you really are at the eye of the storm. And,
right.
and that you're in a place of the world where things happen, oftentimes not pleasant things.
Right.
And I think that's a byproduct of the media. I think it's the way things are reported. So we decided at this time that I would go and that perhaps next time she would go. But as strange as it may sound, we thought the responsible thing to do was to have one of us stay at home with the children and the other travel to Israel. But now that I've been here for a week and I have a sense for more about the country, I think some of those reservations may have been unfounded, but they certainly were reservations that she had.
Right. You know, look, sir, you're blessed because there is nothing like a woman that... that has that intuition and even that concern and that love, because we live in a pretty cold society, and I respect the fact that your wife is looking out for her husband and for her children,
and that's first in both of our hearts, making sure that we're there for our children and raising a family. And and let's face it, Israel is not a place many people get to experience firsthand. Not a lot of people get to visit the parts of the country that I got to visit this week, or to meet the people, or to understand the situation on the ground.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of apprehension. I think if you walked up to the vast majority of Americans and you asked them about Israel, I think there'd be trepidation in their hearts about going there, because what they hear and what they read.
Yeah.
And so one of the benefits, I think, Michael, about me coming here for a week is that I'm able to talk to my constituents about what I saw and what
Absolutely.
I heard and what I learned. And perhaps, as you do on your radio show, you dispel some of the myths, you dispel some of the apprehensions, and you develop a deeper understanding that I think ultimately is going to lead to a stronger Israel and a better world.
Yeah. it's really funny because right now, we're sitting in one of my favorite places in Jerusalem, Alice Restaurant and Cafe. And, we are in the most, and you saw this, we're in the most secure place in the Middle East.
And that's the thing. I never felt at any point, with the exception perhaps of being at the Gaza crossing today and looking at the security with the Palestinians coming in from Gaza into Israel, I never got the sense of there being any tension. I never got the sense of there being, any danger. I felt very safe, very secure. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a constant awareness among the Israeli people about
Right.
security. In fact, I think that's one of the things that struck me most about being here, is that everyone is acutely aware that anything could happen, and you need to be prepared. And they're very security conscious in everything that they do. There's a collective sense of we're all in this together, and we need to look out for each other, much more so than you see in the States. And I'm not saying one is better than the other,
right?
But in Israel, there is a much more of a collectivist feeling that we're in this together, that we all have to have each other's back. America is more of an individualistic society, and that's not to say that we can't rally together and come together in times of crisis.
Right.
But just over here in Israel, with the fact of the geography and the nations around them that are committed to their destruction, I think you create that sense of solidarity, and that comes across very strongly.
Yeah, I was just like I said, I was up in Hebron.
Hebron. Mm-hmm.
And everywhere I've traveled all over this country, I'll tell you, and you spend a lot of time this week with the military, but when I see these young people, I can't call them children or kids, because they go in the military right out of high school.
That's one of the most striking things. We were up on the Golan Heights at Mount Bentall. I'm probably not pronouncing it right.
No, you said it very good.
And there's a place up there at the top, where tour guides gather and children gather and whatnot. And it's amazing to me to see the number of young people with M16s thrown over their shoulder,
yeah.
And they're laughing and playing and no one thinks twice of it. And if you were in the United States and you saw somebody walking down the street with an M16 swung over their shoulder, you would simply say, what the heck's going on?
Right.
Here? But here, the fact that you have to arm yourself, the fact that you have to be ready for anything,
right.
And the fact that it is your responsibility to be ready for anything, you become accustomed to it very quickly. And after a couple, 3 days, it didn't surprise me anymore to see so many young people with M16s swung over their shoulders. It's just an everyday part of life.
Yeah. I say it often, anyone that is a student of history, and if you're not, you should, because our history is being rewritten in the United States, of course. But we have 50 stars. Let me say two things. Number one, if it had not been, as a Christian, if it had not been for God giving Torah to the Jewish people, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, we wouldn't have a Constitution or Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Now, that's just a fact, because our principles came from the Mosaic Law. It's beautiful.
There's no question about it. I mean, Judeo-Christian principles and tenets, you know, they are the foundation. They undergird our Constitution and our body of law in America. So you're absolutely right, Michael. I mean, it's an extension and it's a foundation for our country.
You know, and it, not only do I owe my grandfather for fighting World War II, my father, who was a Green Beret who fought in Vietnam, not only do I owe my founding fathers, but if we're going to be realistic, I owe the Jewish people, I owe God for my internal freedom and the Jewish people for my external freedom. And for me, that's why I chose to come here and take a stand with them. I owe these people as an American. And the other thing is that I was going to say, which, it slipped my mind, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you have been able to see this because, I figured it out now. We have 50, each state is sovereign in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We have 50 stars on our flag.
Mm-hmm.
Israel has one. One.
That's a great observation. And the way that the American Republic is set up, as you know, 50 sovereign states, and they delegate specific powers to the federal government, very limited powers, and
right.
To the extent they haven't delegated them, they have reserved them unto themselves. And as you say here in Israel, and perhaps this contributes to the sense of a collective, we're all in this together mentality, more so than in the states, but you're right, there is this one star on the Israeli flag. And I honestly never got the feeling that anybody felt like, okay, well, I'm a citizen of Tel Aviv, or I'm a citizen of Jerusalem,
right.
Or I'm a citizen of, Haifa. It's always I'm an Israeli, and that's what I am first, last, and foremost. And so that's an excellent observation on your part.
Well, hey, listen, sir, you are my new best friend because you use the word republic and not democracy.
No, we're a constitutional republic. I mean, I think people confuse that sometimes, and they conflate the terms republic and democracy, but we are a constitutional republic in the United States, and I think people also forget sometimes that we're a federalist republic,
right.
And that certain the powers really reside with the people and the states, and that only certain specific powers were delegated to the federal government as the state's agent. And what happens now is the tail wags the dog. I mean, you've got the federal government in Washington, D.C., you know, pretty much acting like it can do whatever it wants, that it has unlimited power. And what you're seeing happening in Washington, D.C., and in the country, United States right now, is a reawakening of these federalist principles, that
right.
States actually have sovereign powers, and that Washington, D.C. doesn't have a blank check. And you're starting to see, I think, a course correction of sorts in the country.
Right. You know what? I don't need to know any more about you, what you just said. The truth, right now, you just fed me a buffet of truth that I'm picking out of my teeth with an ideological toothpick. That was beautiful. That was beautiful. Thank you. I don't need to know any more about you, sir.
Yeah.
That was great stuff.
Well, it's been a tumultuous time in the country right now because you've got the Republican Party, which is typically a party that stands for limited government and stands for, you know, the states having more authority. But within the Republican Party now, there's a split. There are those called the Tea Party Republicans that really want to see the federal government pared back down to its essential core functions. And you've got another part of the Republican Party that, quite frankly, are quasi-Democrats. They want big government as well, but perhaps they don't want it to go off the cliff quite as fast. But
right.
They still want it to grow. And so we do have an internal struggle in the Republican Party right now in the United States, and I definitely count myself in the Tea Party limited government part of it. But that's going to be an ongoing identity crisis for the Republican Party, I think, for the next few years.
Well, let me say this. If I can add to that. And look, this all goes in with what we're about to talk about because it comes back to Israel. But if we do not have a moral compass, then men voted into office are not going to care how they spend your money.
Well, I mean, John Adams said it best, you know, back right after the founding. He said that a constitutional republic is fit only for the governance of moral men. And that if we don't have a moral compass, or if we don't have individuals that are guided by a strong sense of Judeo-Christian ethics, that a constitutional republic won't work. And
right.
I think that's part of the problem we have in the United States today, is that a lot of people that we send up to Washington, D.C., don't have that strong moral compass. They're
right.
not looking after the best interests of the people. They're not acting in what they think in an altruistic way.
Right.
And so you're right. And John Adams was right in that a constitutional republic, governing yourself, only works with a moral and conscientious people.
Right. Wow. Very well said, sir. Look, you know, this goes into what we're going to talk about, and we're going to take a break here in about
sure.
a few minutes, but back to our roots, our first founding principles, and I, you know, it's amazing, and I'm not, we're going to find out, but I walked through Jerusalem. This is where, this is the essence of those principles, that when we not only apply them to our personal life, and I'm not talking about perfection,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that even if you aren't quote-unquote a Christian, that you seek to adhere to those principles, I think it'll make you a better man, a better citizen, a better husband, a better father, you know, speaking from man to man.
Yeah, no question. I mean, and whether you're Jewish or Christian or Islamic, you know, the fact that you're in Jerusalem, what that speaks to is you believe in a higher power. You
right.
believe in a higher set of moral ideals. And again, I mean, it bespeaks that. If you're there and if you're learning, it says something about you as a person. So you're absolutely right. And you get that sense when you're in Jerusalem. You get the sense that you're among a moral people. You get the sense that you're among a group of individuals, whether they're Christians or Jews or Muslims, that do adhere to these things that we call morality. There's these things that we call mores.
Right.
And again, that's irrespective of which of the three major religions I've talked about.
Right. You know, it blesses me, because I come from a small town in West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and when I see packs of Jewish children, grammar school, walking down the street with no adult accompanying them,
mm-hmm.
laughing. In my hometown, in West Virginia, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't do... I see kids riding the bus in grammar school, upper-level grammar school, I'm assuming that safely, and in junior high, just on the bus or on the train or whatever, and it's remarkable.
Well, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you would think that Jerusalem, where you've got, you know, three major religions converging in one place... you're in an area of the world where there's conflict all around the perimeter. You would get the sense that children wouldn't be safe out there alone. But actually, the contrary is true. And that Jerusalem is that kind of a place where the people that are there are extremely and intrinsically moral people. And so it isn't surprising that you see school children that are able to be on their own. There's a sense of safety. And again, that's counterintuitive to what I expected. I expected, you know, it almost to be, you know, a place where you had to watch your every step and look around every corner and, you know, hope that a policeman was on the corner. In fact, I can't remember having that feeling at all during the time I've been in Jerusalem.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Look, it's funny, when I first came in, back in November, they had the rockets going off from the Gaza.
Gaza, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of my friends in the military, they were pulling me. I was staying at a military house in Tel Aviv. I lived here in Jerusalem, so I took a bus down. I wanted to get video. So, of course, you know, they're looking out for my best interest, and they're, you know, Michael, we got to go down to the bomb shelter when the alarms are going
mm-hmm.
off. And, I guess it shows I have complete confidence in the Iron Dome, but I was out. I said, no, I got to get out here and get video. You know, Americans need to see this from a personal level.
Right.
Not an international news level, which doesn't always give us the facts.
Well, what you see on the news are when tragedies occur.
Right.
Or when people have died, or where there's been conflict. I mean, you know, that's what you see on the news. They're not going to put on the news, you know, what happens the other 99% of the time, which is, you know, people go about their lives in a
right.
way that is in a very safe environment. And that's what I take away from this, is that, you know, what we see on the news is not representative of the reality on the ground here in Israel.
Yeah, definitely. Listen, sir, we're going to come right back. Actually, let me say this. We are in Alice. Did I say this? We're in Alice Cafe.
You did. You said we're in Alice Cafe, but you didn't say that it was one of the finest Italian food restaurants in Jerusalem. I'll put that plug in for them.
I appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to come right back. Thank you to everyone that's listening to Insight to Israel. We'll be right back. This is Michael Gannot with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving three right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Ganot. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back. This is Michael Ganot with Insight to Israel in Jerusalem at Alice Cafe and Restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I am here with State Senator Tom Davis from South Carolina. Senator Davis, it's a pleasure to have you here, sir.
Thank you again, Michael.
Great. First half. Fantastic. We did a great back and forth there. And thank you for, look, I don't think Americans hear it enough, that the truth about the greatness of our country, we see our, and about good people in government. I think that, number one, if you are someone that holds the principle in your life, mm-hmm. and lives by that and tries to teach your children, I think too many times we're ostracized in the media by the leftist media, and people that want to be in public service, that are trying to do the right thing and take the right kind of stand, they're ostracized too many times. And I want to say thank you for knowing just what you, I'm telling you, as an American that lives here and hasn't been home in a year, and I don't foresee that happening soon because there's a lot of work to do here.
Right.
I want to say it's refreshing to have someone like yourself on the state level say the things that you did that just are refreshing.
Well, I appreciate that, Michael, very much. And I think people in the United States are waking back up to the way our country was formed, what our founding fathers expected, you know, just precisely, you know, what sort of responsibilities did they want the federal government to have, as opposed to the states, as opposed to individuals. And I think we're going through sort of a constitutional reawakening in America right now. And I really do believe that. And, and I'm encouraged. I know a lot of people are discouraged right now with the, you know, $17 trillion debt that we have. We have annual trillion-dollar deficits. We've quadrupled the monetary base. The Federal Reserve has printed more and more money. We had the government shut down. We got the dispute about Obamacare. There's a lot of angst. But I think coming out of all this is an awareness in the citizenry of exactly what the constitutional republic stands for, what the responsibilities of government are, and which belong to individuals. So I think that there's going to be some good coming out of this tunnel that we're in right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, this comes into, and for all the leftists listening, this is not a political stump for Senator Davis. He's here in Israel, and I want to say thank you for coming. I'm excited because as someone of influence And when you have that influence, it's a responsibility to do good.
Well, and to also, before you can do good, you have to understand. And for me, I mean, I'm like everybody else in the United States. I mean, I read about what happens in Syria. I read about President Obama talking about a red line that's been crossed and then no action is taken. And I read about what's happening I've learned today or this week that you don't necessarily call it the West Bank. It's Samaria and Judea. It's actually the way to refer to it. And so now I'm going to refer to it as Samaria and Judea as opposed to areas A, B, and C. And what's happening in Iran, of course, with whether or not it gets a nuclear weapon. And, what's happening in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood being ousted and the military exerting itself. And so you read about these things and you hear about them on TV. And you know that they have tremendous significance for international community, but you know, you don't really know what's going on, or at least I didn't know what was going on. And so for me, to have this invitation at this time was fortuitous, and everything happens for a reason. And
right.
I think that the invitation came to me because there was an opportunity for me to learn about something that is going to be very relevant in the years ahead.
Absolutely. You know, I want to say, sir, respectfully, because you're my elder, and I respect my elders, and even though we're probably not that far off in age, I'm 43 in December.
I'm 53, so yeah, I am your elder. Yeah.
I want to say, not only are you my new best friend, but I might start calling you daddy because you just spoke a truth that I jest when I say that, because you use the word Judea and Samaria. And I'll tell you, there are people that live in those areas that risk their lives living there because historically, archaeologically, factually, that's their land. And because I believe, in my experience being here, they are kind enough, very kind, very generous, to want to live peacefully with their neighbors. And that's not given to them. If you look at the past treaties, such as the Oslo Accord with Bill Clinton, and when Yasser Arafat was alive, right after that treaty was signed, there was constant bloodshed of the Jewish people.
Yeah, I think based on, I'm learning more about it, that every treaty or every agreement that's ever been signed or reached is honored in its breach, it seems to me. It's interesting to me, Michael, that the way the Western media reports situations, using the language they use, like
right.
the West Bank, for instance, we just talked about.
Right.
Well, implicit in calling a region like Samaria and Judea the West Bank is that it is the West Bank of the Jordan River, and implicit in that is it belongs to Jordan, because it's the West Bank of the Jordan River.
Right.
And that's not the case. If you look historically, if you look at Judea and Samaria, it has been peopled by the Jewish people. I mean, the word Jew comes from Judea.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's little things like that make you open your eyes and say,
right.
well, wait a minute, why do we automatically call it the West Bank? I mean,
right.
why don't we call it Judea and Samaria? And so it's a whole way of referring to the situation
it's a grammatical
in the United
word.
States that reinforces a certain agenda. And
right.
so if you come here and you learn about the history, you learn the proper terminology, you learn about the treaties, you learn about what happened in 67 when you had Syria coming from the north and Egypt from the south, and when you learn about what happened in the Yom Kippur War with Syria and the tanks and the Israelis being outnumbered 30-1 in tanks and how they managed to survive. I mean, it really, all those things that you learn about and have read about come alive for you, and you have appreciation for the events and the people that you never could have before.
Yeah, wow, wow. That's great stuff. In fact, I just did an interview with a gentleman, because right now the Europeans are protesting businesses in Judea and Samaria.
Right.
So this guy brings them under one umbrella, and they find areas in the world that will... They take those businesses, find areas in the world where there's a need, and they reach out to those folks in that part of the world that need maybe that product manufactured
mm-hmm.
or that type of service done. And I actually called the show the First Bible Belt, Business in the First Bible Belt, because
right.
Judea and Samaria, throughout, if I could get a little Christianity on you, biblical, that is mentioned throughout all of the Bible
mm-hmm.
where Jesus did his teaching. So, you know, along with South Carolina,
we have a Bible Belt there as well that runs from Greenville to Spartanburg to Charlotte, all up through that way. So we have one in South Carolina as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's interesting history, very, very rich history That's what excites me. You've got to experience that firsthand. So tell us how we talked in the beginning about how you have friends that 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 encouraged you to come. What was your first thoughts when you got off the plane? I mean, you obviously knew more when you before you got here because you educated yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first impression, I mean, Tel Aviv is more or less a relatively modern city.
Right.
And of course, I was struck by its proximity to the Mediterranean and how beautiful it was.
Amazing.
But really, I really started to get a sense of the history and to really develop a sense of awe when we went to Tiberias and the Sea of Galilee, and I realized that we were, you know, in the area where Jesus was raised, and walking in areas where Jesus had walked. And then going from there up to the Golan Heights and seeing just how close, Syria, is to the Sea of Galilee, and they can be on top of those heights and the view they have down toward Tiberias. And actually, Michael, while we were there, on Mount Bantal, you could hear the rebels and the Syrians in the distance. You could hear the fire, and you could hear the battle, and just the sense of proximity, the sense of how everything is so close, really struck me. And then when we headed back down from the Sea of Galilee, down along the Jordan, coming down to Jerusalem, and then seeing Jerusalem for the first time, and just seeing it on the hills, and seeing it all of the same stone, and it was just an overwhelming feeling. And that's when I really got the strong sense that I was seeing history, or I was feeling history that I read about in the Old Testament,
right,
or the New Testament. I was seeing it become real to me in a way that no book reading can ever bring you.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, I had a buddy of mine who was in the Special Forces of Golani. He was a lone soldier. I shared with you what a lone soldier was earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But he took me, he's a certified tour guide, and he took me 3 days. We spent along the Syrian-Lebanon border. And I will tell you, sir, that when I would look on the other side into Syria and Lebanon, yeah, I'd see a few nice things, but it's like a barren wasteland. Yeah, you see spots of villages and things. And there's a phrase that I use, that this land is God-kissed and Jewish labor.
Well, let me make a point about that Mark Twain wrote a book back in 1869. He famously visited Israel and wrote a book about it. And there was a passage that was read to us by our tour guide where he talks about the hills of Israel being so barren and such a dry and foreboding place and sorrowful. And you look 100 years later and how different it is. And Twain was writing about a Jerusalem that was under the Ottoman Empire rule.
Right.
But 100 years, 150 years later, you're talking about a Jerusalem that has been tended, as you say, by the Israelis. And it is a beautiful, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. So if ever there's a testament to a people taking and nurturing a land and transforming it, this is an experience, and you can just look at the way Mark Twain described it back in 1869,
right,
and what the reality of it is today, 150 years later.
Amazing, amazing. I'll tell you, sir, for 3 days, I told my buddy, I said, Daniel Charter, I told Daniel, I said, please, man, don't get annoyed with me if all I can find to describe what I'm seeing on the Israeli side and what the Jewish people have done in 65 years is wow. Wow.
And they've done it with very little natural resources. I mean, you talk about water, and they recycle 75% of their water. And you talk about, you know, what they've done with limited natural resources.
Yeah.
It truly boggles the mind. And I guess, you know, a necessity of the mother of invention. And so, you know, they had to put their mind to it. I mean, and in fact, they were talking about how the surrounding countries, you know, they were digging because they had oil, but the Israelis had to dig into their mind because they didn't have that.
That is
a very profound statement, I thought.
That is it. This country, you can truly say, was born out of brains and brawn.
No question.
Brains and brawn.
And it just shows what you can do with a finite amount of material if you have enough will and if you have enough intelligence and creativity.
It's refreshing.
It is.
And this, if I could, I want to add, this is the essence the withering height, the taste of rugged individualism.
It is. It is. It's. They squeeze every drop out of what they have here. I mean, there's. You get the sense, Michael, that there's nothing in Israel that is wasted. That every bit of it is utilized. That every bit of it is put to productive use. And that if something isn't put to a productive use, somebody's out there thinking of a way to make it productive. And there's definite that feeling. And as you say, it is truly inspirational.
Yeah, it is. So okay. So you saw Jerusalem. So was this day one?
Day one, and we were coming in, and it was in the evening, and you could see the sun, you know, hitting the sides of the buildings, and it's got that particular glow to it.
That aura.
And it truly was magical. And as you're coming in, and you see the Mount of Olives, and you see the old city, and you see the wall, and then going down to the Wailing Wall, and we were at the beginning of Shabbat, and we got to see them, you know, at the wall, and just, you know, the faithful gathering there, and putting the messages in the wall, and just the singing, and the dancing, and the joy and the way religion animated them. It wasn't some ritual they were going through. It was something that they live, and they were happy and joyful to be there. And it was truly something to see as a Christian, to see somebody that moved by their religion. And again, I mean, the next day we went on a tour of Jerusalem to the Christian sites, and starting at the Mount of Olives and looking down, and then going to the Garden of Gethsemane and seeing where Christ was, and then, you know, just and all of that, and then going to Calvary and seeing the place where perhaps Jesus' tomb was and where the rock was rolled aside, and, you know, being right below where Christ was crucified, and seeing how the drop of blood fell onto Adam's skull, and just the whole reality of it matching up with what you've read about was overwhelming to me.
Right. It's fascinating because, you know, I think it's, and again, let me emphasize to the listeners, I am grateful that you got to come, number one, because you saw the history. But along with that, what Americans, look, I've got pastors that are friends of mine that I went to school with, and they're emailing me saying, Michael, call me. And I'll call them. And I'm not saying it's, I think it's great. Many Christians know about the historical aspect, which is fantastic. It's the basis, antithesis, and the foundation for what we believe. At the same time, though, many people, and that's why I'm glad you're here, they don't know about the modern-day Israel, and again, that struggle for sovereignty and security up against a leftist governments around the world and a leftist media that does not tell the truth about it. So you saw these historical sites. When did you, what did you do the next day, day two?
Listen, the first day that we were here, we were in Tel Aviv, and we actually went to the Ministry of Defense and had a briefing from a senior official to the Ministry of Defense on security situation in the region. We then got to go to a place where they trained the canine dogs and search and rescue and what they do. We also went to a military court to see the administration of justice to those in Samaria and Judea and how that worked. And then after that, we went up to the second day. We went up to the Sea of Galilee to Tiberias and spent the night there. And the following day, went to the Golan Heights and actually rented an all-terrain vehicle and got to ride around and get on the ground down there as well.
Nice.
And then we went down, as I say, day three and four. We drove down the Jordan River, came into Jerusalem, spent a couple days here, and I get the sense that you could spend a month here and probably not scratch the surface. And then after that, we went ahead today, went to the Gaza Strip, and I have to tell you, that was probably the saddest part of the trip for me, in that there was this necessity and this human, you know, kind of a contraption that's been formed to go ahead and regulate the flow of people, because you're afraid of somebody is going to come in from Gaza into Israel and commit acts of terror. And just, it's sort of like, you know, airport security times 10. And I guess that's a reality of Israel, is that you always have to be aware that there are those around you that are committed to your destruction. And so I guess I was glad to have seen that.
Right.
I can't say that part of it filled me with joy. That part of it, you know, really drove home the reality to me that while I feel safe and while the people of Israel are a joyful people, that there are individuals outside Israel who are committed to its destruction, and that you do have to have these safeguards in place.
Yeah.
It's a very sobering thing to see. to that?
You know, when I first came, when I first got here, October 2nd, 2012, I immediately started doing some work with the military, and I was on the bus, and this young lady, probably 19, 20 years old, she works down at a checkpoint on the Gaza, and we struck up a conversation, and she said, and I said, I told her, look, this is a fantastic country. Now, I haven't been here that long, but I've always had a love for Israel in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, she goes, why would you come here? She goes, this is hell. My best friend in grammar school was killed by a suicide bomber. And there was a time that we thought my mother and my sister were killed because the cell phones went out when a bus blew up, and that was the bus. Of course, there's always more than one, of course, but that was the bus number that was blown up by a suicide bomber.
Right.
And she was very emphatic. She goes, I would trade places with you any day to go to the United States. And I'll tell you, this was one of the first coming here. This was right in my face.
First experiences you had with it.
Yeah. And look, not only from external, but they have internal threats. There's a stabbing, and it's increased since Ramadan. Israeli citizens that are Muslim, that have representation in the Knesset, they don't have to join the military, they get discounts at the universities. And recently there was a soldier killed who was friends with a Muslim in a coffee shop that he worked at. This young man, not the Israeli soldier, his brother was in jail because he tried to kill Jews.
Yeah.
This soldier was invited by this young man to his house one night after work, and the kid killed him and dumped his body down a well.
That's one of the things, Mike, I didn't realize about Israel when I came here. I mean, I guess I had this image in my head that it was the homeland, a homeland for the Jews. But that, as you say, is it 20% that are actually non-Jewish?
Yes.
And that they do have representation in the Knesset, and they are Israeli citizens to the same extent that Jews are. And again, I'm embarrassed to say that I was not aware of that until I came here to hear those numbers. That, in fact, it wasn't just a Jewish homeland, that it was a place where you had 20% non-Jewish and Muslims, you know, living amongst the Jewish people. And again, as I said earlier, in Jerusalem, to me, there didn't seem to be any tension. There seemed to be Christians and Muslims and Jews. They were all coming to places that were holy to them. And there wasn't tension. Out there in Gaza, at the checkpoint,
yeah.
I felt the tension.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was, and I guess that's going to be the last image I have, because that's the last stop we had on our tour, and I fly out this morning, tomorrow morning. But that was a very different feeling today in Gaza than
yeah.
the rest of the week.
Yeah, it's troublesome. Then you went down to a town that we talked about earlier called Sderot.
Right.
Which is bomb shelter capital of the world.
Well, and even the playground, you know, equipment where children play, the sliding boards and the areas where they play hide and seek or a tunnel, they also double as bomb shelters. I mean, so...
Unreal.
And bus stops, you know, they double as a bomb shelter. And so, you know, I guess in a way that's ingenuity is to take these things that are necessary because you're so close. I think you have, what, 15 seconds from,
yeah.
you know, the siren sounds to find cover. But the way that they have, you know, woven these bomb shelters, you know, into ordinary aspects of life
and
in terms of bus stops and in terms of children's playground equipment. And as you say, they painted them, too, to try to integrate them into the community. So they're doing and making the best out of a bad situation. And
absolutely.
It amazes me the people that will live there and the people that are still living there. And you see construction going on. So more people are going to live there. And so I can't imagine, you know, what that must do. And they were actually talking about a pretty high incident of PTSD among children
yep.
there.
Yep.
Because they're constantly living under the threat and fear of those sirens going off. And
yeah.
if you think about it, if you're a child, how terrifying that must be
yeah.
To always be alert and aware of the fact that just, you know, a few miles away, rockets may be fired at you.
At any
time.
That's
just absolutely horrifying.
And if the media would report every time there was a rocket, they'd be doing it every day just about.
Well, and we went, there was a police station in that town, and behind the police station they showed us pictures of the rockets and the husks and the remnants to stack upon stack upon stack of them. And they were saying that tens of thousands of these rockets have been fired from Gaza, into Israel since 2001.
Yeah.
And it just boggles the mind. And they showed us the pieces of shrapnel, and they showed us what's inside, and great devastation and harm that it causes. And you're right, the sheer scale of it, stunned me that there were that many. I mean, you hear about the suicide bombers, and you understand that rockets are fired, but tens of thousands of rockets have been fired in the last dozen years? I did not know that.
And, the interesting part is, I'll tell you, and this is what I love, and I'm sure I want to get your insight into that, but the Israeli military goes to amazing great lengths to preserve life. They send text messages to people in fact, let me say this, 60% of the electric and water that goes into the Gaza goes in there for free from Ascalon, while the Israelis pay a higher price.
They do, and then the humanitarian aid that they provide.
Yeah.
And they're very conscious of wanting to abide by international law, and the international law is a humanitarian aid, and so they want to go ahead and make sure that what they do is legally right and correct, as well as morally correct.
Right.
And so you're right, the amount of money that they put in, I'm not sure exactly the circumstances behind the surrender or the distancing in 2005 or whatever it was, but I get the sense that in Gaza right now, it's an economically depressed area with very little vitality, and I've not been in there. And it just strikes me as being a very unfortunate and sad situation. And I'm not sure what to do about it. I mean, brighter minds than I and more experienced minds than I will hopefully sort it out. But it didn't strike me that the people of Gaza were living a very fruitful and productive and happy life.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong about that. That was what I thought.
You're right in a way, but I would encourage you to do the research. Billions of dollars from the world community flows into the Gaza. Billions. Billions. And John Kerry, after Barack Hussein Obama left here and gave a speech, John Kerry went to Mahmoud Abbas and offered them $12 billion in economic aid, while billions continue from the European
to
Union.
Gaza?
To the Gaza, yeah. While billions flood in from the European Union, flood in from the UN, and from around the world.
Yeah.
From every... And this is...
Is that UNWRA? The UNWRA?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And look, every man, woman, and child in the Gaza should be bathing, turning on their spigot and bathing in money. But that money, in the end, as Hamas was voted on democratically by the people, goes towards arms against the Israeli people and building tunnels. You heard
right.
about the tunnels.
Right, yeah. So perhaps it goes for purposes other than what the donors would hope or expect it to go for.
Well, I can only say this, that when you look at these organizations that back the Gaza, many of them are left-wing,
mm-hmm.
and they honestly, I from my assessment, from all the years that I've been watching this, they could pretty much care less. This is not, I've learned here, I knew this before, but being here a year, this is not about land. This is about a Jewish presence. After studying the Hadith, the Sirah, and the Quran, this is about a Jewish presence. And it's amazing how much money goes in there. But that's another conversation. I apologize, sir. I didn't mean to.
Not at all. I've enjoyed this.
But anyway, so, and I'm hoping that after this is the last impression left on your mind.
It is. And well, thanks to you, Michael. I went down and gave blood. I appreciate you.
Oh, that was great.
Encouraging me to do that. I know it's going to go for a good purpose. It's been a remarkable week, and it's one that I'll take back home with me and tell my wife and my family about. And I'll definitely come back. And next time that I come back to Israel, I'll come back with my wife.
And I'll tell you, I would be honored, sir. And I'm so thankful. I thank God that you had the chance to be here. It means, after living with these people and integrating into the culture, when I have soldiers look at me and say, Michael, we didn't know anyone cared because of the media,
mm-hmm.
And to have you here and on Insight to Israel, when a lot of Israelis now listen to Insight to Israel. Thank God. And to know that there are public officials, public servants in the states that are at the state level, and that's what I'm thankful for, at the state level, not the federal level, okay, but the state level, the grassroots, is coming here to find out more about Israel.
And the more you learn about Israel, the better understanding you have, I think the stronger relations become. And I think that will continue, and I'll try to do my share.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. Listen, thank you for giving blood. And when Absolutely. You and your wife come back, I'd be honored to interview you on Insight
to
Israel.
I'd be happy to do it, Michael.
You're welcome.
All right, sir.
Hey, sir, thank you.
Good to see
Listen,
you.
This is Michael Gineau with Insight to Israel. I want to say thank you again. Thank you, thank you. Not only for listening, thank you to America's Web Radio, but thank you for the Hershey's for Heroes. The soldiers, they are so grateful. The look on their face when they see that message it brings me joy to see it and know that Americans care. So I want to say thank you to everyone that listens. God bless the United States of America and its and the Patriot Conservatives that stand for truth. And thank you. And God bless Israel and her greatness and her struggle for sovereignty and security.